Hi, Simon Hill here. Enjoy our podcast? If you'd like to help us keep delivering the sort of quality football chat you want, then you can show your support by making a donation. Big or small, however much you can afford, we appreciate all your help, and every cent will be ploughed back into improving production. Thanks in advance from all of us at Shim, Spider, and so much more.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
It's Craig Moore. What a piece. Beautifully struck home by Craig Moore, and the Australian supporters go wild in Stuttgart.
Why not? Touched by Kalac. Rickson's corner kick.
Celtic couldn't handle Wood on the set piece. It's a brilliant header.
And Cahill goes to spectacular. What about that? What about that?
Here's Aloisi for a place in the World Cup.
For us.
He's got it. Australia got it.
You're with Shim, Spider, and so much more. Take it away, fellas.
Yes, hello again. Welcome along for your weekly dose of Shim, Spider, and so much more. Another huge episode coming up with our special guest, Mark Viduka, and a review of the Asian Champions League success for Melbourne Victory. Joining me, as per usual, Željko Kalats and Craig Moore, who both got birthdays coming up. Spider on the 16th of December and Maury 4 days prior. Both are Sagittarius, a sign of the bow and arrow, and as such, as an archer, Sagittarians are said to never fail to hit the mark, alluding to the power of prophecy. So when you look into your crystal ball, guys, what do you see for football in 2021?
Surely that's not a trick question. 2021 is going to give us crowds. We're going to get crowds in 2021.
Well, that's something. Yeah. What else do you foresee, O soothsayer, Spider?
Look, I think the game itself is gonna grow. I think people are going to be eager to get back to the stadiums and support their teams. Hopefully in Australia, we will get the unbundling right, and there'll be a lot more clubs leading into 2022. So 2021, big year to get 2022 off and running for Australian football.
Maury.
Yeah, hopefully new broadcast deal that secures the future of the Australian game when we're speaking domestically. Crowds, Spider, you touched on. We're going to see the crowds in certain parts of the world start to flow in. We've seen that in the UK recently. VAR, I would love to see the back of it, Simon, but
yes.
I don't think that's going to be the case.
Okay, we shall see what happens. Thanks, guys, for the moment. Let's get on with it. We'll kick off with Hard Talk.
Hard Talk.
Hard Talk is brought to you by Streamgate, which has been live streaming since 2008, specializing in custom-built stream pages, pay-per-view, and multi-language streaming. They can cater to large online conferences with multiple simultaneous streams and destinations, including all social media channels servicing clients Australia-wide. Go to streamgate.com.au or you can find them on Instagram. Our thanks to Streamgate, great supporters of our podcast. Guys, let's kick off on a positive note of sorts. Congrats to Melbourne Victory for becoming the first Aussie team to make it through to the group stage in 4 years, a badly needed shot in the arm for the A-League. Now, unfortunately, Victory went down overnight in the round of 16, 3-0 to Ulsan. But even so, it's great that we got a team out of the group finally after 4 years, guys.
Yeah, I think they've done a great job to get out of the group, especially as we've touched on in previous pods. Undermanned, underprepared. they were outclassed in the last game against Ulsan, but really, they've done a great job to get out. And I think it's a good thing for all clubs in Australia to realise, now that we're going to start the season at the same time as the Asians, I think it'll give us a lot more opportunity to get through to the last 16 from now on.
And I think as well, Spides, just touching on Melbourne victory in particular, fantastic that they got to that latter stage. That's important for Australian clubs. Unfortunately, they go out to Ulsan, but it was a very young Melbourne victory side. A lot of good young players getting invaluable experience, Simon, that I think will augur well for these players moving forward. So a better future, hopefully. Melbourne victory unlucky this time, but it shows what can be done.
And you can say the same thing for Sydney and Perth as well, those younger players getting that experience on the big Asian stage. Unfortunately, I've only just learned this in the last 24 hours. Those results from Melbourne victory will not count towards our coefficient because the AFC Cup was scrapped this year. They've done away with the points that would normally be awarded for getting through to the round of 16. So that doesn't help us. And we're still slipping behind, which is why, of course, next year, we've only got one direct qualifier plus the two in the preliminary stage, which is unfortunate, isn't it?
It is. It ends up being like... you've got 1.5 spots, really, I think, is where we're at with, unfortunately, the lack of results at this particular level. So, look, we've got some work to do, Simon. But again, if we can sort our game out, the reset happens. And I think that there is a bright future ahead for Australian football. Being competitive in the AFC is very important for our success.
We'll come on to that reset shortly. Just before we end the Champions League chat, Ange Postecoglou's Yokohama F Mariners, of course, they take on Suwon in the round of 16 on Tuesday morning. That's before after this podcast has been recorded. Could he add the Champions League to the J-League crown, do you think? Has he got a shot at doing that, Spider?
Look, I've watched a lot of these games. His brand of football is fantastic. They're playing really well. I actually think he really has a shot of winning the title. The big guns, obviously, the Chinese teams, I see a lot of unrest there, except for one, Beijing Guoan. They look like a happy team who are playing fantastic football. So I think one of those two can win it, definitely. Shanghai SIP, I think it looks like unrest there with Hulk. And Shanghai Shenhua, I just don't think are good enough.
No, I don't think they are either, Spides. But you know what I've loved about? I've seen a comment recently from Ange Postecoglou, and I still think that, you know, through parts of Asia, they don't really appreciate the Asian Champions League. Whereas Ange Postecoglou has come out and says, why would you disrespect 90 minutes of football? Every 90 minutes of football that you can potentially get gives you an opportunity to learn, develop and improve. And he was suggesting that comment, you know, towards the AFC. So I think if we can get around that, then we can create a better feel around about the Asian Champions League, which, to be fair, hasn't been fantastic over the years.
And I think, Maury, you hit the nail on the head there. I think if the prize money starts going up and we start to appreciate, like the European Champions League, if we make the Asian Champions League like that and the prize money goes up for these clubs, I'm sure they will appreciate it more and more.
A part of that is, of course, the new revamped FIFA Club World Cup, which will elevate the Champions League in terms of importance. Unfortunately, that's not going to happen in the new format in 2022. COVID has seen to that. China were due to host it. So we're going to be stuck in Japan for another 12 months with the old format. But hopefully after that, the money starts to flow in. Big, big opportunity for Australian clubs if they can get through the Asian Champions League. Talking of Asia, guys, in January, we will have celebrated 15 years as a member of the AFC. Boy, that's gone quickly, hasn't it? Have we made the most of that long-awaited opportunity? It was something that Australia had wanted for so many years. Maury?
The report card for me, Simon, says we can do better. And by that, I think that we probably should have been in a position where we'd introduce more Asian possibilities to our league, which potentially could have brought new commercial partners to our game. I think the thing that has held us back, if I'm being honest, in Asia, is our arrogance and the way that we're perceived. So I think if we can work on that and be, I don't know, be a little bit more humble, Simon. Be
what do you mean by arrogance, Maury?
Well, whenever you speak to people in Asia, there is a perception of the Australians being very arrogant towards Asian football. And it probably doesn't stem from the club stuff, if I'm being honest. It's more to do with the international side of games. But it's something that I've not heard once. I've heard time and time and time again. So we've got a lot of work to do to improve those relationships. And I think once we can achieve that, we've got a huge future in Asia. Mr. Lowy, going back all those years, he had the crystal ball. I feel as if we're in the right place, but we can do better.
Okay. In terms of the domestic league, the A-League, and its long-awaited independence, another deadline came and went last week. Is this going to happen before the season starts? I'll take us back to the quote from James Johnson, the CEO of the FFA. If we don't get it done before the start of the season, we may as well not bother. It's getting pretty close, Spider.
It's a month away. It's less than a month away, less. 3 weeks away. Unless they've got a little rabbit under the hat that they're about to pull out to surprise everyone and maybe come up with a big wham for the start of the season. It could be possible. I don't know. I think we're getting on tight lines.
But what potentially, Simon, I'll ask you, what is the holdup?
I wish I knew. I genuinely have no idea, and I don't think many people do. I know it's obviously been a very tense negotiation between all the different stakeholders. I would imagine that money is probably at the heart of that. I don't think that's exclusively the reason. And I think there's a lot of legal complexities in terms of separating out a league from the governing body. But goodness me, it should have been done by now. I mean, they had an in-principle agreement, excuse me, as long ago as July 2019. And here we are in December 2020. And we're still going. And every couple of months, we have a new deadline. We're going to be independent by August. We're going to be independent by October. It's going to be the end of November. And still we're waiting. It's very, very frustrating. And of course, all the while that the league is not independent, the clubs are sort of on hold. They're waiting, as they say, for the keys to the car so they can drive it away and, you know, hopefully take it to a better destination. But it's got to happen soon. Anyway, we'll wait. We've been waiting a long time. We continue to wait. I think I was clean shaven when we started the wait. Just on the domestic game, it confirmed this week as well that the FFA Cup winner, or whatever it's going to be called, is going to earn a slot in the Champions League preliminary round, which is a great carrot potentially, not just for the A-League, of course, but for the NPL teams as well. An open draw, a standalone final. These are the proposals. Potentially a neutral venue, maybe Canberra, maybe somewhere else. What do we think of all that?
I love that idea. That's the one thing I really do love. The only thing that I'm a little bit skeptical and I'm a bit wary about is that the NPL clubs don't go silly and start spending ridiculous money to play a big part in that, because that could actually send the NPL clubs backwards.
Yeah, but I love the idea of, like it says, FFA Cup final, FA Cup final, Canberra, Simon. I love that. I love that idea. Having an actual venue for these finals, so it doesn't change from season to season, year to year. And I think it's, let's be clear to the listeners, because I spoke to Peter Philopoulos at the FFA, because I'd seen a tweet that he put out during the week. Just because of our coefficient points, it will be half a spot. Yeah, so that means obviously still there's a qualifying process to actually get to Champions League stage. So I think it's just to be clear to the listeners who maybe don't understand that.
That's right. Full crowds should be back for the start of the A-League season. The grounds are going to be open, which is great to hear that the fans will be back. Should the league be setting KPIs in this regard? I don't know what you think, but I'd quite like the A-League clubs to sort of try and challenge themselves a little bit and say, you know what, this year we're going to aim for an 11,000 average. Whether they reach it or not, who knows? But it'd be good for them to actually start to challenge themselves a little bit and say, we've got to get bums back on seats. Do you agree?
I agree, and I don't think why it can't happen, because if I seen the question that you wrote in the rundown for us, and I went through all the clubs, and I actually think they can get them. Because if you have a look, they realistically, they can achieve that 11,000. If we play at boutique stadiums, like we seen last year with Sydney, they played at Cogra Jubilee. And every game they had 12, 13,000, 14,000 in a capacity of 17 or 18. So it's doable. 100% it's doable.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And I agree, Simon. I think like whether it's the actual bums on seats or more the KPIs of memberships. Yeah, like so. I mean, there's no reason why clubs can't have 10,000 members, and that's every club. I mean, I was at Turf Moor at the weekend, which is just under 22,000, and even if you had 10, 12, 13,000, it would be unbelievable. So there's no reason why A-League clubs can't get 10,000 members across the line.
Well, Brisbane Roar should certainly be able to fill Dolphins Stadium at Redcliffe, capacity of about 10,000. Story in the Queensland Press this week, Maury, I'll come to you on this one. Of course, we know that Brisbane have taken all their home games to Dolphins Stadium and are now training on the Gold Coast. Their former coach, Miron Blyberg, quite controversial comments saying that Brisbane's move has taken the game in the state back 30 years and he's calling for a second Brisbane team to play central. I don't know whether that means that Miron might be involved in that, but I'm not sure I agree with that totally. I think Dolphins Stadium is a terrific venue and arguably in terms of atmosphere, well, not even arguably, it's much better than Suncorp. I know it's a fair way out, but you're from that part of the world.
Well, I am. And look, I've known Miron for a long, long time. And, you know, we've gone back and forwards a little bit. He's out there, let's be honest. But even when I was working at Brisbane, Simon, I've always felt a second team in Brisbane is a great thing for the league because I don't believe Brisbane Roar have moved forward in the manner that we know that they could have. They had a fantastic opportunity on the back of huge success. And I actually believe another Brisbane club will keep them honest and, more importantly, will make them improve.
Give them a derby game as well.
100%. I mean, you know, don't worry. Look, they've moved to the Gold Coast. So I feel sorry for the fans in terms of their trainers moved to the Gold Coast. The game's now at Dolphin Oval, which is a great setup, I've got to say. I've really enjoyed watching the game there because it creates an atmosphere. But a second team in Brisbane, even when I was working at Brisbane Roar, I think is a good thing for the league.
Okay. What about a team in Wollongong, Spider? Wellington Phoenix are going to play their home matches there because, of course, they have to be in the hub. Will the locals turn up to watch the Knicks? Is this an opportunity, particularly with the wonderful Wind Stadium down there in the southern part of New South Wales, to say, look, we deserve a team here?
Look, I definitely think they will turn up. I think it's a great venue. Wollongong have always supported their teams, so they've always had crowds. Now having the possibility of having an A-League club playing out of there, I'm sure they'll jump on board. I think it's a great, great opportunity for Wellington and a great opportunity for the Wollongong people to show that they can have a team in the A-League.
Super setup at Wind Stadium. Just one more before we move overseas. It's sort of overseas anyway, but it's an Aussie coach. We had him on the podcast just a couple of weeks ago, Kevin Muscat. Unfortunately, maybe we jinxed him a little bit. He was sacked this week by St. Truiden in Belgium, just 2 wins in 14 games. Maury, is, you know Muskie pretty well. Is he going to stay over in Europe and look for another shot, or would he head back to Australia? There is a gig available, of course, at Newcastle, if he was interested.
He won't be coming back to Oz. Right. Look, I mean, absolutely gutted for Muskie, but as we know, the only currency in Europe is results, Simon. And unfortunately, you know, for Muskie, the last two games in particular against teams below him, you know, had a draw and had a loss. And like I says, business is business over here. But you know what? I'm convinced that Muskie will go on and learn from the experience and go on and be a great coach. You need a little bit of luck when you go into these clubs. And unfortunately, those draws didn't turn into wins. But mate, he'll dust himself down and be back on it. But I don't see that being back in Australia.
It is a brutal business, isn't it? Football coaching. Thanks for the moment, guys. Let's head overseas then, shall we? London Calling.
London Calling.
Well, before we head to London, let's start in Barcelona. Spider, more trouble for Barca, beaten by Cadiz in La Liga. And last week, Leo Messi. I find this extraordinary that football's power brokers do not understand this. They fined Leo Messi $700 for revealing a Newell's Old Boys shirt after he scored against Osasuna in tribute to Diego Maradona. I mean, goodness me, where are our priorities in this game?
Ridiculous, ain't it? He's honouring one of the greatest footballers ever to play after scoring a goal. His childhood hero, and he gets a fine. Like, absolute ridiculous. But look, that's the governance of the game at the moment, ain't it? $700, it won't hurt Messi, but it's just ridiculous. As for Barcelona losing to Cadiz, it happens in football, and it's been happening quite a lot lately, which we've spoken about. But I will remind you that Barcelona had about 32 shots on goal. It was one of those nights where it just would not go in.
Spides, they're 12 points. They're 12 points off top of the table, though. And I know, you know, even now to be sitting in ninth position at this stage of the year, a lot of work to be done at Barcelona, and potentially, we've been speaking for a little while now, it's a changing of the guard, isn't it? It really is, because who knows what's going to happen with Messi next year.
Well, just on that, I mean, that the incoming president has caused ructions within his own club. Ronald Koeman in particular, not happy with the fact that he said we should have sold Messi during the off-season last year. And again, it sort of hints that all is still not well behind the scenes with Messi and Barcelona.
No, well, that's quite clear for everyone to see. They've got a big match against Juventus now in the Champions League. They're going to go through in the Champions League, but in the league itself, very poor at the moment. Probably a lot of it's got to do with motivation as well, Maury. I mean, you know, they play these big Champions League matches. They come back and they play someone like Cadiz. They think they're going to win easy. These teams are prepared for this one-off match. Rest a few players, blah, blah, blah. Many shots on goal. Ball won't go in. It's just happening all over Europe, not just to Barcelona, but the Messi thing is a real big saga for them.
Good to see former Manchester City striker Alvaro Negredo get the winner. I remember him from his days at the Etihad Stadium. Just on Maradona, kudos to Napoli, who've renamed their stadium after one of the greatest players to ever play the sport. A fitting tribute to Diego. Before we get to the Premier League, Gianni Infantino speaking out this week, Maury, backing the use of VAR, saying, and I quote, "It is not damaging football," and says, "Sometimes it's used in the wrong way. Spare me, please." Are they not taking the temperature of football fans here?
Yeah, can we talk about the Premier League? No, Gianni Infantino. I mean, look, this is the problem. When you have the majority of the football community saying that they're not happy with what they're seeing in the VAR scenarios within football matches. Simon, you have to listen to the fans, you have to listen to the players, and you have to listen to the coaches. And it's not been good. I'm sitting watching a game thinking, when the way that the game's going, do we actually need linesmen now? Is that going to be another thing there? Like now when you've got all the technology and all that sort of stuff, do you need a linesman other than standing in between a skirmish? Do you need a linesman to say it's a throw into A or B or it's offside?
Hang on a minute. What's a skirmish? That's a Scottish word, isn't it?
Yeah, well, you know, maybe an argy-bargy separating players. But, I mean, I'm thinking, well, we need to – there's certain parts of the game that you cannot change. It's tradition. It's what we love. It's what fans were brought up with. And I just, Gianni Infantino is severely lacking the point here, really.
This is the politicians actually making excuses for the rubbish that they've brought in.
It doesn't improve the game, though, Spides.
Mate, you're telling me, mate. It needs to go. Well, and they're not linesmen, Maury. They're assistant referees.
That's right. Yeah, they've been renamed. I think we're all on the same page there, but some, of course, listening today will disagree. That's fair. Everybody has the right to an opinion. Let's move to England then. Fans back inside the stadiums in England. Well, a few of them anyway. Up to 2,000 in Tier 2. Manchester United's game at West Ham was the first game to host supporters. My question, is it a bit early? Maury, you're over in the UK at the moment. I don't know what the situation is in Scotland, but I mean, in the UK as a whole, there's still up to 15, 16,000 new positive COVID cases every day. Would you be going to a game? I know you do go to games because you're paid to go, but if you were a fan, would you be going to games in the current situation? Is it too soon or not?
mate, 100% I'd be going. I mean, look, is it too soon? I mean, look, I'm not being blasé when it comes to health and safety, obviously. I mean, in Scotland, up north in the lesser tiers, Simon, it's, I think it's 300 fans are allowed in. Down south, obviously tier two, 2,000 supporters. And with the process and protocols that are in place and the social distancing.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Look, there's a lot worse scenarios in other parts of life that we're dealing with on day to day. So, it doesn't overly concern me. Hopefully, like I said, we'll get to see more and more at the right time, but because health and safety is the most important thing here.
All right. Spider, in terms of the top of the Premier League, wins for Chelsea 3-1 over Leeds, and Spurs defeating Arsenal in all sorts at the moment. Are we set for a title race that perhaps doesn't involve the so-called big two, Liverpool, Manchester City, this year? Are Chelsea and Spurs going to scrap it out for the crown?
Well, look, I didn't watch a Spurs game because there's a million games on today. I watched Chelsea. They were outstanding. By the way, Man United are right up there. They're scarily just like plodding away, but they are still massive contenders this year. Man City, massive contenders. Liverpool absolutely battered Wolves tonight, and they were hot again. Tottenham are a very good side. Look, I have no idea which way the title's going to go. Honestly, there's some teams, when you watch them play week to week, sometimes they play really good, and the next time you watch them play, they're just toilet. But the idea is getting results when you don't play so good. And that's what these teams are doing. And it's very tight at the moment.
Yeah, Spurs and Liverpool have been they've been the most consistent. I don't know how much with the injuries that Liverpool have had, Spides, and the way that they're still performing in terms of mentally, how that may impact other clubs, because they probably felt that maybe they had a chance to get a little bit of a lead on Liverpool with the injury situation. But I tell you what, Liverpool just keep going from strength to strength. Players come in, new people tested, and still getting results. But Spurs were very good, very efficient. You know, Mourinho 2-0 up, doesn't need to chase the game after that. Arsenal have been hit and miss. Man United, as you touched on, excellent away, undefeated in the Premier League away from home this season.
9 consecutive away wins, Maury. And Bruno Fernandes scoring in his 6th consecutive away game. He's the first United player to do that since 1964. And they're developing a bit of a pattern, aren't they? They fall behind away from home, but they've got the mental resolve to come back and win. Are they genuine contenders, in your opinion? Look, you're looking a bit dubious.
I don't know. Again, because we all keep kind of, I guess, you know, saying that things are not happening for Manchester United, but as Spider said, they're in a good position. Bruno Fernandes is an excellent player, and I think he's been a wonderful acquisition for Man United. Pogba come on also and starting to show a little bit more, Simon, a little bit more. So, look, Ole, to be fair, Gunnar Solskjaer still making errors. I think he made an error during the week in the the Champions League, with not taking Fred off. You can't make those mistakes, but Man United are doing okay.
Yeah. Made a similar error at the weekend as well, leaving Fernandes and Rashford on the bench. But when he brought them on second half, boy, did they change the game around. And what a goal that was from Paul Pogba as well. Goal of the weekend for me. All right. Thanks, guys, for the moment. Let's move on to our final segment today. Really looking forward to this one, Footballers' Lives. And we have another huge guest waiting for us.
Footballers' Lives.
Well, our guest today was born in Melbourne in 1975, and he grew up wanting to play for the Melbourne Knights. He did just that and so much more besides. He was already an NSL champion when he left Australia to play for Dinamo Zagreb in 1995. And he went on to have a stellar career with Celtic, Leeds United, Middlesbrough and Newcastle United, scoring well over 200 goals in a 16-year career. He represented Australia on 43 occasions, scoring 11 goals. And, of course, famously captained the Socceroos at the World Cup in Germany in 2006. These days, he divides his time between Croatia and Australia. And he's been good enough to join us on the pod today. We're absolutely delighted to have Mark Viduka with us. Good to see you, Dukes. How are you?
Good, guys. Nice to see you guys as well.
How is life in Croatia running the coffee shop?
Well, at the moment, they've closed everything down. So there's no coffees, there's no takeaway coffees and stuff like that. And so we're having a bit of a break.
So what are you doing with your time apart from doing podcasts with us?
I drink a lot of coffee, to be honest, obviously.
That's fair. Well, let's move away from coffee and start all the way back with your early days with the Melbourne Knights, or your early days as a child in Melbourne. Football, I know, was a big part of your life, and you were a Melbourne Knights fan. Were you steeped in the game from as early as you can remember through your family?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was, I think, from the first time my dad took me to a Melbourne-Croatia game at the time. That's all I can remember, really. I was pretty young, maybe 4 or 5 years old, and we used to go every week. And we followed them religiously. I think from day one, I knew I wanted to play football, you know. Whether I was going to succeed or not was a different thing.
Do you remember your debut in the NSL when you'd signed for the Melbourne Knights? I think it was against the Preston Lions, according to Kyrie on Twitter. Wants to know if you remember it.
No, my first game was actually, I was at the AIS and I came the season before that. I played against the Adelaide Sharks. And I had a haircut like this as well. But that was my first full game was against Preston at their ground. And I remember I scored two goals that game. So, of course, I remember it.
The start of many. Those days with the Knights and winning the NSL title in 1995, I mean, that was a team that it doesn't get remembered an awful lot in Australia, but it was full of quality players, yourself included.
Yeah, we had a really young squad, first of all. I mean, the year before that, there was a lot of older players that were in the team and really good players, you know, like George Hanna, Theo Salamidis, you know, there was Vaughn Coveney, Ivan Kerlich and players like that. And Mirko Bazic came from overseas and he, for some reason, he wanted young players in. And then he started looking for local young players and, you know, brought in Danny Tiaro from Werribee, which Werribee was in the, you know, second division or the state league at that time. You know, gave more airtime to players like Adrian Savinski, myself, Steve Horvat, also he was young. Frank Juric, the goalkeeper. And we were a young squad at the time. Nobody really knew whether we'd do well or not. But for some reason, you know, Mirko Bazic put us together and we gelled really, really well. And firstly, I think we were a really good bunch of guys, mates off the field. And secondly, on the field, we worked hard for each other.
Your Croatian heritage, of course, saw you sign after you left the Melbourne Knights. And there was a lot of speculation, a lot of interest in your services back in those days. But you ultimately signed for Dinamo Zagreb. I remember reading that the president of Croatia himself wanted you there. How did all that come about?
Well, yeah, I mean, I had an offer at the time from Borussia Dortmund. I was actually about to sign a contract with them, and we just won the title with Melbourne Knights in Adelaide, and I was waiting for the end of the season to sign this deal and go there. And what happened was, I was at one time training, I think it was, and one of my friends from this Croatian political thing called me up, and he said, the president's in Melbourne, he wants to have a lunch with you and your parents. And I thought, I mean, that was, for us, was a huge thing. At the time, Croatia was just, you know, it was in war, and it was a big moment for Croatia in history, because they were, you know, what is it called? I'm thinking in Croatian at the moment. they were sort of in the stage of, you know, setting up a new country and, you know, from nothing. And it was very exciting for the Croatian community down in Australia as well. And so we came to this meeting, and, you know, he said that he was setting up this club, you know, from Dinamo Zagreb, that he wanted to promote Croatia in the world and that, and he wanted me to go and play there. And at the time, it was very difficult for me to say no to, you know, to something like that.
You basically had no choice.
What I'm talking about.
You basically had no choice. You said, okay, I'll come and play for you.
Exactly. I mean.
But yeah. Dukes, how in terms of that, I mean, we know the preparation that you had at the AIS and also the game time, obviously, with the Knights. But how much pressure for you with your background to go to a very big club, knowing that you're going to have to produce? Was there a lot of pressure? Did you think about that at that young age?
To be honest, not really. I mean, at that stage, I was, you know, as when you're a youngster, you don't see the negatives, do you? You know, you just see the positives. You're looking at the situation in, you know, in totally different eyes, as, you know, compared to when you get older and you go for all these things. But, you know, I went there, you know, full of energy. I just came, you know, I was top scorer in Australia. I was player of the year, and we won the title. So it was, you know, a really, really I was buzzing at the time, and I didn't think of the negatives that can happen, you know, in those sort of situations. You know, as you know, it's very difficult for anybody, and I think that's a huge test for any player, is you know, when a club pays a lot of money for you and you've got to perform. It's a very, very big test.
Dukes, you won league titles with Dinamo Zagreb, but fair to say, by the end of your spell with Dinamo Zagreb, things had turned a little bit. I think the fans got on your back a bit as well, didn't they?
Yeah, it was. Things changed after three and a half years I was there. Things changed a little bit in the situation. You know, it's very difficult to explain the situation in Croatia on one podcast. So I think you'll need a whole bloody 6 months of talking to explain the situation. But the thing is that, you know, it got to the stage where, you know, I think I needed a change from here. You know, I loved living here. Living here is, you know, Croatia is one of the most beautiful places in the world to live, and a lifestyle. And here is, you know, second to none, really. But when you're involved in football, it's totally different. You know, football's run in a totally different way than it is in the UK, for example. You know, there's, if you see all the different, you know, the corruption here and all that in football, and, you know, you can't compare it to the UK or Australia and things like that. So in those times, you know, the fans started getting on my back. I think I got a hard time from a lot of the journalists at the time. You know, they were using the president's unpopularity, you know, they were, you know, making stuff up, as journalists sometimes do. No offense. but in the end, it was a situation where I'd scored a goal in the derby against Hajduk Split, you know, full stadium, you know, 30,000-40,000 people, and my own fans, after scoring a goal in a derby, were booing me. So, and then I started realizing, you know, this isn't about football anymore. You know, it's about more than that, you know.
You'd often said that in the past that the UK wasn't really to your liking in terms of the style of football, but you ended up going to the UK and staying there really the rest of your football career. You signed for Celtic initially and had two prolific seasons there. Why did you choose Celtic specifically?
I think Celtic chose me, to be honest, in the end. You know, we played a Champions League qualifier here for Dinamo Zagreb against Celtic, and we beat them in it. So we qualified for the Champions League ahead of them. And over two legs, I played really well. After that, they came into the club and they made an offer for me. So that was how it came about. But having said that, as a kid, I always was a Celtic fan. You know, like in Scottish football, I was, because of my Catholic background and stuff like that, my dad said, you know, out of the two clubs in Scotland, you've got to go for Celtic, you know.
Luke, you kept that one quiet at the AMS.
Did I?
Dukes, you played alongside some great players at Celtic, Henrik Larsson, Ile Birkovic, Stilian Petrov, but you couldn't quite win the title in your 2 years with Celtic. Rangers were a bit too good. And I've got a Twitter question here from somebody called 92/93. And he wants to know if Maury's challenge on you when you were clean through on goal in the March 2000 Old Firm game was the best tackle you ever received. I don't know if you remember that one, either of you.
Guys, I spent 2 years at the AIS with Craig Moore, so that was nothing compared to some of the tackles we got at training.
Do you remember that one, Maury? Right.
Yeah, we spoke about it. Simon, we spoke about it last week. It was a horrible night, Dukes, which normal Scottish nights can be. Yeah, the wind, the rain, it was very wet, and hugely competitive as the Old Firm games always are.
Yeah, did you enjoy playing in those games, Sir Dukes? I bet you did.
Oh, can I tell you something? I mean, there's been so many rumours going around, and to be honest, I haven't really commented on any of that since I left Scotland. But, you know, I loved living in Scotland. I loved the people there. The people there were fantastic. I mean, me and my wife, we had such a good time over there. And the Celtic fans are crazy. I mean, they're crazy. They're some of the best fans in the world. I would say the Old Firm derby is, if not, one of the biggest, if not the biggest derby in Europe, definitely. I mean, you can't compare that, you know, because there's a huge history there, and there's also religion that fuels a lot of it as well. So, you know, playing in that game, I mean, basically for 90 minutes, you cannot communicate with your other players, you know, because it is so loud the whole time. But you know, it was a pleasure. I really enjoyed Celtic. For me, in my time of when I was there, it was very, very badly run at the time. You know, when I got there, Joe Venglos was there. Then they brought in John Barnes. Then they brought in Kenny Dalglish. And then after that, it was who was after that? I think it was another local coach there was. So in the space of a year and a half, we had four or five managers, and the team atmosphere was no good. You know, if you're in Glasgow, if you're one of the two Old Firm teams, second is like last, you know. And you know, Maury's been on the end of the press and all that. If you're coming second in Glasgow, it's not a pretty place to be, you know. And it's not about that. That's all fine, but I couldn't see it, you know, getting better at the time when I was there, you know. But you know, thankfully O'Neill came in later on, and he did a great job, and I'm happy, and I love Celtic, and I love, you know, my kids are Celtic fans as well, and we follow them as much as we can. So I think to be honest, in a lot of times I've been unfairly criticized, because in the year and a half there, I was top scorer and player of the year. So it's a little bit, you know,
something that still eats away at you a little bit because
well,
of that?
You know why? Because the thing is that I think football, if you've been involved with football, people are so emotionally involved with their clubs. You know, it's like when they lose a player who's done well or something, they get upset. It's like when you know, break up with your missus or something, you know?
That's a good analogy, Dukes. Well done.
You had another couple
of... It's true.
Yeah.
And then what happened with this thing in I went to Leeds and then David O'Leary did an interview saying that I was only tested to 70% of my ability. And then that went into Scotland saying that I only played, you know, that I did that interview saying that I only played 70% of my ability, which, you know, if I played 70% of my ability and I ended up being player of the year, then what were the other players playing at?
you've segued nicely for us, Dukes, into your time at Leeds. You signed there in 2000 for David O'Leary. Your first season, again, you were pretty prolific, 22 goals, including a famous, very famous game against Liverpool where you scored all four in a 4-3 classic at Elland Road. I know you played a heck of a lot of fantastic games, but that's got to be up there amongst the best, hasn't it?
Everybody asked me this question. Everybody asked me this question. It is. Obviously, it's got to be up the best. But I'm telling you honestly, I came off that pitch and I thought I wasn't happy with my outside-out play, you know, like, I wasn't happy with the receiving, wasn't happy with dribbling, wasn't happy with holding it up. Those things I wasn't happy with, you know. And I've played in games 100 times better and I never got a sniff on goal, you know. And that's football for you. You go out there and you don't know what's going to happen. You go out thinking that it's the best, you know, that everything's going to come off well. But then sometimes it doesn't. This game, I got four sniffs at goal and every one of them went in, you know.
But you were just in that groove as a striker, weren't you, in that particular game, that you look at the chances and some of them weren't easy chances, but you were so good technically that and so in that zone at that moment that you were able to finish all four.
Yeah, but that's what I said. Sometimes you wake up, you know, and your head's hurting you in the morning, you know. You know, the southerly wind's hitting you in the head and you're thinking, my God, what sort of a day is it going to be? And then sometimes you wake up and actually that day I had a shocking sleep because my missus kept ringing me up all night. We were in a hotel in Leeds with Danny Milosevic. I was in the room at 3 o'clock in the morning. The dog started barking and my missus rings both of us, wakes us both up. And she goes, and that was, mind you, was an 11 o'clock kickoff in the morning, right? And our pre-match was at 7. And so she rings up twice in the morning, once at 3 and once at probably 4 or 5, you know? And the second time when she rang up, I said, if I have a shock, I'm going to kill you.
So the following week, you got her to call you at 4 and 5 in the morning again.
Brilliant. Go on, Maury.
Dukes, your time obviously Leeds, that was a very exciting team. We're great to watch, mate. But I've also had a couple of conversations with you and asked, from January onwards in seasons, you always seem to be on fire. Goals used to flow then. Explain to the listeners, because you've explained to me a few times the reasons why.
Because his contract was coming up.
From January. Hold on. I don't know which explanation I gave you, Digger.
Right, well, you said it took you a little bit longer than the normal person to get to full fitness. Was that something maybe?
Yeah, that's true. No, because it took me a long... I wasn't feeling properly fit until like November time. Honestly, yeah. It took me that long to get match fitness, because the most important thing as footballers would know is match fitness. You know, you can train all until the cows come home, but if you're not match fit, it's difficult. And so what happens is to be able to go through that 90 minutes and at a really high intensity and feel okay afterwards, you know. And it always took me a longer amount to do that. I don't know why, but I didn't feel good up until about November-ish time, you know?
Interesting. Dixie, you had some interest from AC Milan reportedly in 2001, but the move didn't happen. Is that a club you'd have liked to have played for? You might have played alongside Spider at some stage in the future. Why yeah. didn't it happen? And is that a bit of a regret for you or not?
You know what? It's difficult to say regret. I mean, I think things happen because they have to happen. You know, I don't think it's something where, you know, I don't know how you can regret. I don't think I regret it. When I came to Leeds, that first season, we had such a really, really, you know, good season. We were in the Champions League semi-final and all that sort of stuff. And they wanted to re-sign me on a new deal after the first thingo. Peter Ridsdale wanted to re-sign me on the thingo because I had a lot of interest from other clubs. You know, and AC Milan was one of them who were very interested because I know I'm quite good with Boban, Zvonimir Boban. And through him, they had approached me. And so they were sort of, you know, they were really, really serious. But then what happened was Ridsdale put on a huge price tag. I don't know. It was over 30 million. I don't even remember. I think it was 38. I don't even know how much. He put a huge price tag on my head because he didn't want to sell me. And they wanted to offer me a new deal. And to be honest, at the time, I just moved from Glasgow down, you know, I got settled into a house and all that sort of stuff. I really wasn't in the mood for moving either, you know. And I enjoyed it. And I thought, you know, Leeds is a club that I really enjoyed living up in Yorkshire. The way things were, it looked like we were, you know, they were going to invest more money, buy more better players and, you know, stay in that sort of region, and little did I know it went the other way. So,
mate, I know when I got to Milan, they said to me, "I can't believe your big mate didn't want to come to Milan when I got there." But the pre-season and the way they prepared for the seasons, Dukes, would have suited you perfectly because we were never prepared except for January and onwards, because that's when you won the Champions Leagues and all that. So Milan was always prepared from January onwards. Would have been perfect for you.
Yeah, probably. the thing is, you know what? I think I like the actual, also in the UK, I preferred the thing of where, you know, they used to go into quarantine before games, you know, like weeks at a time. And I hated that. I did that in Croatia and they'd be like before three, four games before a game, the days before a game, you'd be in a hotel for some reason. I don't know the reason. Whereas in England, they sort of let you do, you know, be home with your family as much as you could. And to be honest, I felt better that way. I didn't like, you know, being in hotels for like a week before a game. You know, at the end, you're pulling your hair out.
Your time at Leeds, Mark, didn't end particularly well. As you mentioned, the club were relegated, financial issues. I think you were also sent off in your final appearance as well against Bolton, although you typically scored. you signed for Middlesbrough in 2004, a club with whom you played in the UEFA Cup final. You got to the FA Cup semis. What are your memories of your time with Middlesbrough? People don't tend to associate you with Middlesbrough in some way, and yet you played in the UEFA Cup final for the club.
Yeah, it is. It's a funny thing that, I mean, we had a really good squad as well at Middlesbrough. Lovely bunch of lads, and not just the players. The whole surrounding there was a nice surrounding. We had Steve McLaren at the time, who, you know, had a lot of experience coming from Man U, and I think we sort of were a bunch of. There was a lot of older players, you know, over 25, you know, between 25 and 30 and even older than that, who had a lot of experience and you know, won a lot of things. I mean, we had Mendieta was there. There was Reisiger from Barcelona. There was...
Was Yakubu there, dude? Was he your strike partner?
Yak was there, yeah. Yeah, Yak was there as well. We had George Boateng, Gareth Southgate, Schwartzy was there, Hugo Ekiog.
Players.
We had a good bunch of guys and players who were sort of towards the end of their career, not end, but like, you know, in the 30s sort of area. And it was a really good environment. I really enjoyed it, you know. And you know, we got to the quarter over the final of the UEFA Cup. you know, that's for a club like Middlesbrough, that's a huge thing for any club, really, you know.
Yeah.
You know, on the day Sevilla was a lot better.
I read that it took you 4 months to get over that loss to Sevilla in the final. Is that true?
Yeah, I was gutted. I thought, you know, considering the games before that, I thought this is, you know, God is on our side, you know, that we were going to go through it. And because we the two games before that, it was like unbelievable comebacks to win the games. You know, we were losing 2-3 nil over whatever aggregate and all that, and came and scored 4 goals or something like that. In 2 games, we scored 4 goals in the semi-final and the quarter-final to get to the final. And I thought, you know, God is on our side. But once we got there, we realized, you know, that we're up against a really good team who on the night were, you know, they were better than us.
Dukes, your final club was Newcastle under Sam Allardyce. Again, unfortunately, it ended in relegation. We didn't probably realise it at the time, but you were coming towards the end of your playing days. I remember reading, or you might have even told me, that you had the chance, I think, to join Fulham the season after. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. But you turned that down. What was the reason for that? Were you starting to feel that your body wasn't perhaps, you know, still in the right condition to play football, or you just had enough of it mentally? What was the scenario?
I think it was a bit of both. I was at the time when I was at Middlesbrough, the last 2 years I had a lot of problems with my Achilles. And anybody who's had any Achilles problems knows that it's very, very painful. And what I used to have to do before every game, I used to come earlier and have like a special warm up and all that, and that'd be really painful at the start. And then once I got into the warm up, once they warmed up, they were fine for the game. But then after the game, they'll be like that night, they'd be sore, as you know, really, really sore. And that I was doing that week in, week out, and training sessions and all that sort of stuff. So it started taking a toll on my Achilles, you know. Once I got to Newcastle, that's what happened, you know. I was okay once I was at Middlesbrough, and a few, like at training, I remember I'd do a jump and the Achilles just outstretched. And for most of the time there, I was you know, the second season I only played 5 games, and that was the last 5 games to the end of the season. And, you know, and I knew that there was situations, you know, you'd be there in front of, you know, a full stadium, 50,000 people, and the ball would come across. And in my mind, I was there, you know. In my mind, you know, I'd done it a million times before that, and I knew that I could get the ball, and just my body, I'd miss it, you know, by like, but normally I know it's mine, you know what I'm saying? So, and then I realized it was time to, you know, I didn't want to hang around, and how can you say? I didn't want to hang around just for the sake of it. I thought, you know, I'd rather leave on a note of, you know, knowing that I can do my best on the pitch.
Dukes, we just missed each other at Newcastle. I think I went back to Brisbane when you come to Newcastle. Was it Shearer that was a coach when you were there?
Shearer came in the last couple of months.
Yeah, yeah.
But again, Newcastle was turmoil.
It was in turmoil kind of when I was there as well, because I went from Souness to Rota to then so I played with Shearer obviously as a player, but you experienced him as a coach. What was your I mean, my take on Alan Shearer was I actually thought he was a fantastic person. He was hard, but he was honest, and he has, especially in the northeast in Newcastle, he has this aura about him. What was he like as a manager?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he wasn't there for long, but I liked him. I really did. You know, he came with Ian Dowie, and they set up training sessions and all that sort of stuff. We were sort of towards the bottom when he came in. I was injured. You know, I'd been injured for most of the season. You know, because I would cut, I'd go get back into training, and then get my Achilles was stuffing me about again, and so I was there. I was like, I wasn't in training sessions. But I felt an energy from him. I felt he, you know, really wanted the best for the club and for the players. I think he was, I found him a straight talker, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
An old-fashioned type of a player, you know, and coach. And I really enjoyed, you know, his presence around the place and you know, his training sessions. You know, it would be, it would have been good to see if he, you know, that situation he was in, there was a, you know, it could have went either way.
Yeah.
You know, it would have been good to see, you know, if he kept coaching somewhere else or something like that. But I, as a bloke, I liked him.
Mark, you might have sort of half answered this already because of your Achilles problems. But after you left Newcastle, there was a bit of a sort of a void where we didn't know whether you were going to continue playing or not. You never actually formally announced your retirement. I remember your wonderful quote, "Well, I never announced when I started playing, so why should I announce when I was retiring?" But before all that happened, there was a lot of speculation that you might come back and play in the A-League. Was there ever a formal approach, and did you consider it? Asks Ivan Hasemovic via Twitter.
Yeah, I was approached by Melbourne Heart at the time when I came back. But as you know, as I said before, the second part of to that thing, not the physical side of things, the mental side, I'd had enough of it. You know, I'd had enough of it. You know, when you live that sort of intense lifestyle for that many years and you're under constant pressure, you know, week in, week out, it takes a toll on you, I think. You know, it depends. Some people like that sort of lifestyle. Some people don't. I'm the type who sort of, I like my privacy, you know, I like to keep my things private and you know, obviously the family side of things and whatever. And after a while it started, taking its toll. And I thought, you know, mentally I really wasn't up for it anymore, you know. And once that gets in you, once, you know, like I had the attitude of at that stage, I thought, you know, I'd look at a ball and I'd think, you know, have it. I don't want to fight for it anymore, you know.
Yeah.
And once you get to that, I mean, it's finished. Because primarily football is a fight. Number one is a fight, you know, because you've got a battle every week. You've got a battle against the as a team battle. And secondly, you've got a battle against the guy who's marking you or you're marking or whatever. And if you don't have that competitiveness in you, you might as well throw it away.
100%.
Mark, this is an interesting question, and it sort of leads on from what you just said. You were quiet for a long time after you finished playing. Arto Harkkinen has asked this question. It's our question of the week. Congratulations, Arto. $100 meal voucher for Outback Steakhouse coming your way. Given how active you've been recently in public to try and improve football, particularly in Australia, in contrast to the silence for the majority of time since retiring, what's the biggest motivation for you speaking up now and why not earlier?
Well, I think it was, there was an interview that I did, you know, look, football was my life. I loved it for all my life. And whatever it is, you know, maybe I don't have that same sort of passion like I did, you know, when I was a kid and growing up, but it's still, you know, it's a huge part of me and so is Australian football. And I don't want to see it in a situation, just looking from the side and speaking to a lot of people over the years, it's been neglected for a long time in Australia. I'm not talking about the A-League. The A-League was set up, but the side of things where, you know, the ground, the grassroots and stuff like that has been neglected for that many years. And also the fact that they have a lot of players like ourselves, whatever, here, who have a lot of experience at the highest level and know what it takes, you know, they know how it's run overseas. And for many years, they've been ignored and pushed to the side for some reason. Now, whether that reason is because people are insecure about their own positions in the, you know, in the governing bodies or whatever. My dog keeps barking here. I don't know what's going on.
What's the dog's name, Dukes?
Coco. Yeah. He never barks. He just, when I'm bloody on the iPod or whatever, podcast, then he barks. I was going to say, for many years, I feel that it's been neglected in a long way, and it's been probably run the wrong way, especially the way that the youngsters have been brought up, and you know, and the you know, that whole sort of junior system and going forward, and a lot of the old NSL clubs who have huge traditions, I think they've been neglected for many years. So, you know, I took that opportunity. I'm not one now who, you know, who's every week on dingoes, but I took that opportunity to, you know, say my point of view.
Dukes, just to follow up a little bit on that, I mean, not so much talking about the Australian development system, but the Croatian system, which you know a lot about. We've spoken about that in terms of that continual conveyor belt of talent that they seem to produce.
Yeah.
Can you explain a little bit as to why that is the case?
Well, first of all, genetically, this part of the world is very good at ball games, whatever it is, whether that's basketball, football, they've got some sort of a thing in their genes which, you know, contributes to that. But secondly, I think the system is an old-fashioned system, which is basically the best players play, you know. And I know it's a harsh system in Australia. People don't believe in that sort of stuff. They think, I think we have to separate in Australia, community sport and trying to get the best player, make the best players, develop the best players. And in the developing the best players side of things, it has to be the best versus the best, and the best players play. And basically that's it. And that's how it is here. And everybody knows that. Everybody knows that. So what they do is the best players are filtered out.
Yeah, but not only the best players, Dukes, but how important, because of that, it's a little bit brutal if we're being honest, but so therefore the kids coming through have a fantastic mentality and therefore are able to adapt to other environments, yes?
Exactly, Digger. And one of the things that, you know, growing up in Australia, we didn't experience that much is the negative side of football, you know? For me, as a footballer, as an ex-footballer, the most important part of being a footballer is your mental toughness. You know, you can have all the skills in the world, but if you can't produce on the weekend, you know, it means nothing. You know, and we've all seen unbelievable players who are, you know, at training and all that are unbelievable, and then when it comes to the game, they can't do it. You know, so mental toughness. Now here, I think the whole system's like that, even which I disagree with in schooling, but in sport, it's like that. It's just, you know, brutal. You know, a lot of the coaches are very demanding on the kids and they go through this mental preparation for a lot of it, you know? And so they're used to being bagged all the time. They're used to being booed. They're used to, you know, it's not, it's, that's how it is in football and in life in general. If you don't get through that, you've seen that. Let me ask you a question, both of you. How hard is it, right, when you've had three or four bad games, right, and you're playing in front of your home crowd, 50,000 people or whatever, 20, 30, 40,000 people? How hard is that when the ball comes to you?
You're begging not to make a mistake. You just want to make the right decision the first time. If you don't make the right decision the first time, it just you become more anxious and more anxious. So a mental part of the game is huge. And I agree with what you say, Duke. So I think the young kids in Australia aren't mentally challenged by our system.
And the best players should play. How novel. Dukes, we could talk about that particular issue for a long time, but I want to finish off by touching on your international career with the Socceroos, and in particular to start off with that night against Uruguay. After so many near misses, finally the national team gets through. I remember your interview afterwards, and you looked up to the heavens and just said, "Thank God, it's happened." It was almost like a relief for everybody. Yeah. But the question somebody has asked us on Twitter from a guy called The Real Death Stare, which is an interesting Twitter handle. He wants to know, did you think you'd blown the Socceroos' chances when you missed your penalty in the shootout? I think you actually missed 24 hours prior as well. Graham Arnold told me that. You practiced penalties at that end. Is that right?
It was like that. Spider was in goals. Yeah. Now, when Spider's in goals, the goal looks very, very small in front of you. Right?
Zeke, you might remember all those years Sydney Croatia against Melbourne Knights at the Croatian Sports Centre. I saved your penalty there as well, son.
Chuck that little dig in as well, won't you?
That was a long time ago.
I remember that as well. Now, well, you know what? When things like that happen, when you go out onto the pitch at the start of every game, you don't know what's going to happen. I mean, obviously, that was a special game, you know, the way that it went to extra time and all that sort of penalties and things like that. And, you know, I've had a lot of penalties before that. I've taken, you know, heaps of penalties before that and scored them, you know, for Celtic, for Leeds, for whatever, when I was youngster and all that sort of stuff. And that time I missed, you know. And to be honest, at that moment, I don't think there's no time to think, you know. You're in front of, you know, I don't know, 80,000 people and all that sort of stuff. Everything and nothing goes through your head, to be honest, you know, when you miss something like that, you know. Thankfully, at the end of the game, you know, Schwartzy made the saves and, you know, Johnny scored the winning penalty and we went through. And obviously, if we didn't go through, it would have been shocking. Even though I was gutted for months after that because I missed the penalty. I'm still gutted today about it. Those are things that never get out of your system, you know what I mean, as a footballer. I reckon Diggers gutted probably about a tackle he probably did, you know, for Rangers that he missed or made a penalty. To this day, when he thinks about it, he doesn't like it. You know what I mean?
I'm sure that...
Why not to? Some things do stay with you, Dukes, in terms of those kinds of moments.
Some things do, you know.
Because you also...
That's how it is. You live through all these things. People think that, you know, there's a lot of, you know, footballers get a lot of praise, but they get a lot of stick as well for, you know, not wanting to play for the badge and doing all that sort of stuff. I don't know any player that goes, not many anyway. I've seen maybe a few in certain situations, but first of all, you look like an idiot if you don't want to play out there. And secondly, you know, anybody to get to that level of football, every week has to give his best. You know, I mean, it's something, you know. Yeah, what did you want to say?
But no, you ended up making a decision, Dukes, because remember we played the preseason. We played the pre-World Cup game against Holland. You also took a penalty in that game. I think you missed it, but we scored, I think, on the follow-up.
Timmy scored, Timmy scored.
1-1, by the way. We were chasing the ball for fun that game. Holland weren't bad. But you made a decision after that game not to stand up for the national team to take penalties, yeah?
I don't know if I made a decision, but I don't know. I don't think we had any after that.
Well, you did because Craig Moore scored one of the World Cup.
for that one. Yeah. No, but that's right.
He just led you into that nicely so he could just remind everyone that he scored the penalty in the World Cup.
Is that why? Yeah. That's right. It was too.
Let's talk about that World Cup in 2006. Was that one of the proudest moments of your career, Mark, to lead the team out under Horst Hiddink, who'd played a bit of good cop, bad cop with you, hadn't he? He'd sort of cajoled you into getting a bit fitter, and that was the stick. And then with the carrot, he gave you the captain's armband.
Yeah, I don't think, you know, that was made a big deal out of that good cop, bad cop thing. I don't think it was that, you know, sort of at training and all that sort of stuff. You know, he would say a few times, I've got to lose some weight and all that sort of stuff. But I don't think it was that sort of serious, you know. And at the time when, you know, when he was decided, I think Craig Moore was injured at the time when he sort of decided that I would be, were you Digger or something like that? I don't even remember.
I had hamstring problems at Newcastle, and you know what the treatment was like there, unfortunately.
Yeah, I know that.
let me tell you, mate, Goose Hiddink, mate, only had one thing and one player that mattered in that team, and it was Dookie. Dookie was his favourite player, mate.
Don't start with that again.
I don't think he knew anyone else's name but Dookie. Dookie this and Dookie that. Come on, mate.
What do I say to that, mate?
Mark, how did you find his regime? Because he was, I remember being in Milo ahead of the World Cup in 2006, where he put you all through a pretty brutal pre-World Cup, sort of mini pre-season, if you like. I remember at the end of one training session, you were flat on your back and you stayed there for a good 5 or 10 minutes. Literally, you were cooked. And I don't think you were the only player that sort of suffered under that regime. But he got you all so physically in the zone, didn't he, for that particular World Cup. He knew that you weren't necessarily going to be the best team in the tournament, but you were going to be one of the fittest, if not the fittest.
Yeah, I mean, we had a really good training. I don't think I've been that fit ever, to be honest. And also doing the stuff that I love doing. You know, we kept doing, it wasn't, you know, like he's giving us sprints every day. But we were doing, you know, short, small-sided games. Then we go to larger games. Then we'd do shape and all that. And it was really enjoyable training as well. It wasn't just, you know, getting somebody fit for the sake of it. There's two ways of getting you fit. You can do it. You can try to get somebody fit but mentally kill them. And then there's another way of getting them fit but doing the stuff that they love doing and they don't even realize that they're doing it in the session. And that was that whole sort of training camp up to there. We had so many good sessions. That was one of the most enjoyable pre-season type of things I ever had, you know. And I felt really, really fit and sharp. And he did get, you know, it was the intensity was always very high with Gus, you know. Whatever sure we did. And that's one of the things that got us physically fit. And not only that, it gave cohesion to all of us. The exercises he was doing was designed to get us working as a unit, but not working as a unit thinking about it, subconsciously as well, get us working as a unit. So, for example, if the ball went out to the left, it wasn't confusion which player was going to go out there. One player knew that they were going to go out there, you know, and in those situations, it takes away that split second of indecision, which can cost you in a game.
Yeah.
And that's what for me was the big difference with that. You know, everybody was knew exactly what their job was when we had the ball, when we didn't have the ball, you know, when we were attacking, when we were defending, whatever, you know, in certain areas. And that was a really enjoyable, the whole World Cup was an enjoyable experience. Yeah. But that whole training before that was
first class, Dukes, wasn't it? Because I remember we used to do blocks of 7 minutes and it was kind of, it was set to certain scenarios in a game, whether we're winning the game, whether we're drawing, whether we're chasing the game. It was so detailed, and one thing that Gus Hiddink has, again, he had this aura and this experience of, I've been here, I've done it before.
Exactly. And you know what? You know what impressed me the most about Gus, I mean, was his team talks before games. You know, most people would think, most people, you know, you watch all these things on TV and, you know, all these coaches and they're yelling and screaming and the passion and all that. What Gus was portraying before every game was calmness.
Yep.
You know, calmness and confidence. You know, and I remember before the Uruguay game and all the other games, I mean, you know, I remember him saying, look, this is how we're going to play. We all know our jobs. If they score a goal, so what? We can score another one. You know what I mean? So in mentally, he's already did that scenario of, you know, because when you go out, before a game, everyone's thinking, oh, everyone's in a thing saying, we can't concede, especially you guys, defenders, you know? But he said, he sort of released that sort of negative type of energy or whatever, that fear, by saying, okay, we can cop a goal. We can come back from that.
He believed in the team.
Exactly.
He definitely believed in the team. And I think once he's seen the pre-season that we did leading into the World Cup, I think he believed even more after that.
Yeah. And look, in those tournaments, especially World Cups, you have to have a little bit of luck.
Yeah.
You know, you have to have a little bit of luck. And that's, you look at even with Croatia, played the last in the last World Cup, you know, they didn't play the best. Even Italy, in our World Cup 2006, they weren't playing the best football, but they were getting through games. They weren't losing games, and they had a little bit of luck in the end, you know. And that's what it is, you know. If we had a little bit of more luck, things could have been differently. Because, you know, even the game against Croatia, I thought we outran Croatia, you know, at times. Mm. We were unlucky. You know, obviously that first goal, the second goal, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I think it was. I think, to be honest, in that Croatia game, I think they had more luck, and we were sort of more dominant, I thought, you know.
And you should have had a couple of penalties that night, Dukes. You had quite a battle and with Joe Simonich.
Exactly, and that's the thing. You know, in another day, that would have been a penalty for us. In another day. Yeah, you know, there was the handball as well. That there was two handballs.
Yeah.
That's a good mate of mine who did that, Stephen Thomas. The thing is that, you know, and then there was the three yellow card things. I mean, how's your luck, really?
Yeah. What
would have happened? That's a good question. I'll ask you a question, my podcast question. Am I going to get an Outback steak? Am I going to get an Outback steak from $100 or what?
100% be arranged.
100% Dukes. I'll talk to the owner, mate.
It's got to be a good question first, though, Dukes. Come on.
The question is, what would have happened? What would have happened if we had lost that game?
Well, you'd have been out.
Yeah, but out. But then so the referee has given this guy instead of send a red, what is it called, a red card. He's not sent him off. That's a huge advantage to them. Mm. And that was like, what, how many, 20 minutes to go or something like that.
Were you having conversations with Joe Simonich about that?
Joe Simonich comes to my cafe over here. And
so you still talk about it?
Yeah. He lives here around the corner.
we just finish off with a question about the Asian Cup, Dukes. You did play at the 2007 Asian Cup. I think you know this question is probably coming as well. There was an infamous interview with Graham Arnold, who said to our Fox Sports reporter at the time, Murray Shaw, that the players don't want to be here. Now, you did the follow-up interview and seemed a little bit incredulous when Murray asked you for your thoughts on that particular statement. You said, he said, what? So Ivan Stragan asks via Twitter, what is the truth about that situation and whether Arnie lost the dressing room at that tournament?
Well, look, when that interview happened, I was like surprised, and I didn't know what, to be honest. It was live in Australia and whatever, and I didn't know what to say. The guy asked me the question, and I thought, you know, what do I say to what he's just said to me? You know, there's people who don't want it. Whether he was referring to me, whether he was referring to different players and all that sort of stuff, I don't even remember what my answer was at the time. But I said it in that last interview. I said Arnie made a big mistake by promising five people the captaincy, or whatever, three, four. I don't know how many it was. And then in the end, he didn't know what to do when because he thought I wasn't going to come. And when I came, he didn't know what to do. And he sort of maybe, he played that one a little bit, you know. As I said, he was at the start of his career at the time and maybe wasn't that experienced.
He got it wrong at that time, mate. He's, you know, we all live and learn and move on, mate.
Exactly. And I don't know what I would have done. You know, I probably, you know, at that time, if I had done that, I really don't know what I would have done. But for me, as I said to Craig a lot of times, it wasn't the most important thing for me to be a captain. There's players who all they dream about is being captain. For me as a player, it was more of a burden than something that was, you know, whether it was for a team or whatever. It was more of a burden than some sort of a thing, because I just wanted to think about doing my job. You know, I didn't want to think about, you know, what time's the meeting tomorrow or, you know, lunch.
Don't we all know that? That was the last thing on your mind.
Didn't you just have Josip Skoko to tell you when lunch was and training and everything?
I tell you what, if it wasn't for him, I would have slept in for most of them, to be honest.
Mate, if it wasn't for Skokes, we would have played with 10 players every time. Thanks for the missed the time.
Oh, brilliant.
I was just telling, actually, I had a chat to Craig the other day. I was telling him that I was in a Champions League game for Leeds one time. I was in the toilet for the half time, and the game started, and I was still in the toilet, you know? everyone went out. Everyone out. What's it called? And I couldn't hear anybody and I was in the toilet. I couldn't hear anybody outside. And I come out, everybody's gone, and the game's already started. So I just ran on. I didn't know what to do.
Dix, we're coming towards the end of our chat. We should let you go in a couple of minutes. Just a couple more questions. First of all, we know you're involved with the starting 11 now with the FFA. Is that going well? And do you have future plans to be involved with football in Australia, either as a, I don't know, if you're interested in coaching or coming back doing other stuff? What are your future plans, or are you quite happy serving coffees when COVID permits, of course, over there in Croatia?
Yeah, you know, it sounds good, right? It's a good story that, you know, me standing behind the bar putting coffees, but really all I do is drink them, to be honest. Right? That's all I do, you know. And in that interview, I made one coffee just for the sake of it, whatever. But really, I don't even do that. So I'm just enjoying life at the moment. When it comes to starting 11, or is it starting 11? Is it 11? Yeah.
Yep.
Because there's more people than 11. That's for sure. There's probably about 60 people.
Let's just do experience. Starting 64.
you know, when. Look, I think it's a good initiative and all that. It's difficult for me to be sort of involved full on with that, because it's different time zones. It's different, and I don't know the ins and outs at the moment, you know. But whatever I can contribute, I'll contribute. You know, I don't have to, you know, I've got no financial gain out of that or anything like that. It's just, you know, more goodwill thing to try to help out. The, you know, the same as the boys, you know, from the Golden Generation and all that sort of stuff. So when it comes to coaching and all that, for me, as I said, I wanted to, you know, spend a lot of time with my family, with my boys. They're growing up, you know, they're going to come to an age where, you know, they don't want to hang out with me that much. So then we'll see. Maybe I'll go back into football. Maybe I won't, you know.
Okay.
But being in football is it's 100% or nothing. You know, it's not, you can't do it half-heartedly.
You're right. And the final question is from Valandi on Twitter, and it's the most important one. Macchiato or ristretto?
I actually drink a cortado. I don't know if you've heard of that.
What's a cortado?
It's a Spanish. It's in between it's in between a macchiato and a latte. So okay. It's a little bit more milk than it's a Spanish one, and it's in a little glass thing.
So it's a flat white in a fancy glass.
Yeah, you know, you've got to fancy it up a bit.
Dukes, I've got to ask you the big question, mate.
Oh, here we go. This is Spider's weekly question.
So, mate, you've played at the best stadiums in the world, right? So we want to know, what's your favourite stadium you've played at? But the one the fans always want to know is the biggest dungeon that you've played at.
Hey, you know what, Spider? When you've asked me that question, let me tell you something, all right? Your old home ground was one of the worst dunnies I've ever seen in my life. It had one of those, I swear to God, the San Siro, the worst toilets. They had those ones, you know, those, what are those?
You had the chuchni, you had the stand.
Yeah, the chuchnuts in Croatia.
And the away dressing room was terrible at the San Siro.
You know what, when we played you guys in the Champions League with Leeds, I looked at this toilet and I thought, I can't believe Marco van Basten had to do a number two in this.
Dukes, the home dressing rooms weren't like that, mate. I remember playing against them as well. I said, mate, this ain't possible.
God.
Home dressing rooms had gold toilets, Dukes.
Which you would have enjoyed if you'd have signed for them.
That was shocking, by the way.
So the San Siro is the worst. What was the best stadium, Dukes?
No, it's a good stadium, but the toilets are shit.
Literally. What's the best stadium you played at?
Oh, gee, best stadium.
The San Siro, except for the toilets.
Yeah, that's a good one. I would say that one of the most impressive ones for me was the one in Munich.
Allianz.
The new one, Allianz.
Allianz, yeah. That was one of the most impressive ones, you know?
Yeah, terrific stuff.
Your biggest dungeon, Dukes, without the toilets.
In all of them you're talking about. I'll tell you what, in Croatia, there was some very bad ones here.
I thought it had to be Croatia or Scotland, one of those two had to come up with a dungeon.
Well, Scotland wasn't too bad. I don't know. You know what I'll say? The Morwell Falcons.
That's not bad, Dukes.
All those years ago.
That's one out of the archives.
That one? Yeah, well, give them a mention.
Brilliant. Hey, Dukes, we're going to let you go, mates. We've kept you over an hour. Thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate it. It's great to see your face and hear your voice, and hopefully we'll see a bit more of you over the coming months and years. It's been wonderful to chat. Thanks so much, mate.
No worries, Dukes, mate. Great catching up.
Thanks, Dukes.
Great to see you. That's Mark Viduka, and that is us for another week. Join us again next week for another edition of Shim, Spider, and so much more. We'll see you then.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.